Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One.
Welcome to this Rattlebag public interview. Let's start with a question. After John Grisham, who is the most read writer on the planet? And he's a man who came late to his calling, penning his first book, The Pilgrimage, at the age of 38 in 1988. But since then, there's been no turning back. Title after title, his books have flown out of the shops, and not just into ordinary homes like yours and mine, but into Bill Clinton's White House and Madonna's Californian mansion. It's reckoned he sold 32 million books worldwide, and his work is available in 52 languages. His books have had a life-enhancing impact on millions of people, according to the London Times. The Irish Times said that he is that rather science fiction-sounding thing, a phenomenon. He's just written a new novel, The Devil and Miss Prim. It's the final part of a trilogy, which includes By the River Piedra, I Sat Down and Wept, and the hugely popular Veronica Decides to Die. Like its companion volumes, The Devil and Miss Prim sets out to examine a week in the life of an ordinary person faced with a major life-changing conundrum. Would you please welcome the answer to the question I posed, everybody's favourite Brazilian author, Paulo Coelho. Paulo, as I've said, The Devil and Miss Prim is the final book in a trilogy. It's about a week in the life of one Chantal Prim, a woman who was anything but prim and proper. Now, for those who haven't read it yet, tell us a little bit about it.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for such a warm welcome. As for The Devil and Miss Prim, it is a book about this battlefield that it is our soul, in the sense that sometimes we regard ourselves as good people trying to do our best, but there is also a dark side that we take time to recognize, and then when we finally recognize, we start to blame ourselves, and then we stop doing the things that we should continue to do despite the fact that we have this dark side. So at the very beginning, I was thinking, are we good, are we evil? And one day I said, well, I have to write about it, because my way of understanding myself is by writing books. So I took a small village in the mountains of the Pyrenees. I don't mention, but it is in the Pyrenees. And then a stranger comes to this town and he proposes a crime. He asks the villagers to kill someone innocent. And then it is when we see that rules can change very easily according to the circumstances. But the microcosmos of Visgoz, this city, this village, is somehow reflected in our souls.
We'll talk a little bit more about The Devil and Miss Prim later, but let me take you back over some of the events of your early life, as is, I think, widely known. From the time, particularly of your last book, Veronica Decides to Die, you were committed to an asylum by your parents in your youth. Can you explain why that was?
Why? Well, I was too young, and I went to my mother, and I said I want to be a writer. I felt very much comfortable in writing. So she looked at me with this typical, you know, mother look. And she said, oh, yes, you're going to be a writer. First, become a lawyer or become an engineer, and then later you can be a writer. And I didn't accept this as an answer, so I tried, first of all, to connect with artists, which is, according to my mother, the most dangerous species on Earth. So I start meeting them. I started going to a theater group, and at the end of it, she started getting desperate and desperate. Finally, she didn't have any way to control me, and she went to a doctor. And then my father and my mother, they went to the doctor and said, oh, my son, he's lost. He doesn't obey me anymore. And so probably he has a kind of mental problem. And the doctor, based only her opinion, he said, oh, probably he needs a kind of psychiatric treatment. He took me to the hospital. Of course, I was there 3 times. I ran away, escaped 3 times. Till at the end of my 3rd time, my mother and my father, they went to me and said, oh, this is my poor son. and we tried to help him, but he doesn't want any help. So we are going to take care of him. We are going to support him for the rest of our life. And they let me alone. They let me do the things that I wanted to do. But the fact is that from the moment on, I had to face reality. I had to become an artist or become a writer. So from the moment that they said, okay, now we can do whatever you want to do, I panicked. I panicked because I started to realize that it was much more difficult than I thought. So I went to the first publisher. I showed my fantastic manuscript for him to read. And he said, oh, you're 18 years old. You don't have enough age to write anything. And then I went to some theater producer for a brilliant play that I had in mind. And I said, it's useless. You still don't have enough experience to write. So then I started to realize that it was much easier to be mad than to be an artist. And and I went to my mother a fourth time, and I said, why don't you take me to the asylum? Because now I recognize, yes, I cannot do anything, so it's better if you lock me there again. And she said, no. Now you have to take care of your life yourself. But when I look back, I fully understand my parents' attitude. It was not based on hatred or something bad. They really wanted to protect me. Probably they took this decision out of a desperate act of love, trying to protect me instead of trying to traumatize me. So, but there are some battles in your life that either they kill you or they make you stronger. And I think that this was my case. From a very early age, I understood that I have to fight for my space, which I did. So little by little, in just trying to write lyrics for songs, trying to write for newspapers, till in 1987, I wrote my first book.
In relation to the asylum, though, what was that like as an experience? One of the things, for example, that you did experience was ECT, electric shock treatment. I mean, what was that like for somebody who was, there was nothing wrong with?
Sounds horrible, but it's not that painful. I know that it's... I could dramatize the situation, said, oh, I was there and I had this electroshock therapy. I had electric shocks later in a dark period of my life. But in fact, you are asking me the sensation that you have when you have electric shock. It's horrible to see, because when you see this kind of, I don't know how to say it in English, contractions, right? But they put some things here and then you see like a curtain is closing, you don't feel any type of pain. And then when you, it sounds morbid, doesn't it?
I have a reason for asking.
Well, anyway, and then you wake up and it seems that the electroshock therapy, the shock erases the first level of memory. So I remember the first time that I took. Of course, I didn't know that I was going through this treatment. The doctor just said, oh, just lay down here. And no, it's not going to, there's no pain involved, so relax. But I remember that when I woke up, I knew that I have something very important at 3:00. I remember this as if it was today. But I didn't know what it was. What I had to do at 3:00. Little by little, I realized that there was someone very important going to the hospital to meet me. And it was my girlfriend. So it took nearly 3 hours till you can recover this type of memory. So she was there, she looked at me, and I didn't, I had forgot a lot of things concerning our relationship. So she was a little bit scared, and she said, did they do something to you? I said, no, I went through an electroshock. But, and she was a little bit, of course, paralyzed, you know? I said, it's painless, don't worry. Because it seems that we are always concerned about pain, isn't it? If it doesn't hurt, if you don't feel anything, it is okay. But if you feel, it seems that it is unbearable.
Later on, you became something of a hippie. What attracted you to that lifestyle?
Yeah.
There's a segue. No, electric shock treatment to hippies.
You know, electroshock and they're hippie.
Well, it's going to be a lot of that.
Yeah. But but it has nothing to do with electroshock.
No, not that I'm aware of.
But back to the hospital, I remember that I used to type. I was reading Oscar Wilde at that time, and he is still a kind of icon for me. And he wrote this fantastic text on when he was in jail, and I tried to do the same thing. So I used to sit there and type out, you know, a long, endless poem. And I remember now that when Veronica Decides to Die was published in 1998, my publisher, because this was a kind of hidden secret in the family. So, and my parents, they blamed themselves for the rest of their lives because they took such an attitude. I was always telling them, please, it's not that serious, it happens. But they were very concerned. So one day I went to my, well, I decided to write Veronica Decides to Die, that it is part of the trilogy, and I had to talk to my father. So I went to my father, I said, I'm going to publish a book, and I'm going to mention that I was in a mental institution. And he was very concerned because he thought that from that moment on, nobody would believe in anything that I write because I could be considered a mad person. So I talked to him, no, relax. And my publisher had some doubts about whether this was true or not. So he decided to ask for the records, the magical records. And we got it, even if it was 30 years ago. And it was written there that I have such a strange behavior because I used to type a typewriting machine till 3 o'clock in the morning. Like, you know, this is very strange. Nobody does a typing till 3 o'clock in the morning. But I remember that Oscar Wilde played a very important role at that moment because he was through some very difficult ordeals. That's why I think that writing books is something very special, because it's not that you're going to change other people's life, but at least you're going to tell to these people that you are not alone, that and then you connect to them and you get a kind of extra strength, as Oscar Wilde gave me at that moment. If you read my books, I normally mention Oscar Wilde, even if there is nothing to do in The Alchemist, for example. I open the book with the Narcissus story by Oscar Wilde, and then Valkyries I mentioned. So, to go back to the hippie.
Well, I actually thought Oscar Wilde was the first hippie, so I thought that was the answer to the hippie question.
Probably. But anyway, so yes, then after being released from not being released, after escaping and trying to return and didn't succeed in returning to the mental hospital, I went to the university, and I was there. I started studying law for 2 years. But I felt very uncomfortable because that thing has nothing to do with me. But I was there just because I should be there. You know, no explanation. Well, if you're young, if you have 19 or 20, you have to go to the university. Regardless of the fact that the things that you're studying are meaningful for you, you have to go. So I was there. I was very bad, very, very bad in studying law. So. And one day, this hippie movement started. We didn't know exactly.
That would have been a Wednesday.
Morning.
Wednesday morning, okay.
We didn't know exactly what it was all about. We knew that they used to have longer hairs. And in Brazil, that it at that moment was under a kind of military dictatorship. They tolerate that because they consider this to be less dangerous than getting involved with politics. So we had access to information. And I felt totally identified with them in the sense that they accept the fact that they were different. And not only that, they behave like different people. And I thought, oh my God, I'm not alone. I'm also different. So all the different people, they can go together very well. So, to be a hippie means you have to travel and you have to meet other hippies, of course, because you cannot be a hippie in your room, you know. You can have a poster of, you know, of
it's
Jim
in the
Hendrix.
Hippie commandments. Thou must travel, thou shalt meet other hippies, yeah?
You can have a poster of Jimi Hendrix, you can have some books, but, and then you have to have the real experience. So And the real experience is that most memorable thing that happens in our lives, that it is meeting people. So I managed to get some money. I was giving some classes on theater, and I went to Europe. And then it was that I met people, and by meeting people, by meeting different people from different countries, and sharing with them this way of life, I think that it was at this moment that I realized first that it is much easier to fulfill a dream than you think. Because when I arrived in Europe, I remember I had $200, that it was nothing, even if you consider that it was in 1970. But then I could sleep, I could eat, I could travel, I could, find a girlfriend, I could do everything. And I still had, at the end of this long journey that lasts, I don't know, for 6 or 7 months, I still had $20 in my pocket. So, but it was the moment also that I think that the hippie movement, it was based in some very interesting parameters. One of them, it was the spiritual search. Everybody was trying to find a meaningful life. So Hare Krishna, Buddha, and occult. And then I start to learn. I start to learn in the best way that you can learn, because you are curious about that. And I started to contact people, and I saw, oh my God, this world is so interesting, because I was, just to go back a little bit, I was living in Brazil in that particular moment that we had this military dictatorship there. So to be in Europe, to be in Amsterdam, it was like a paradise, although people there used to consider paradise is very boring, you know. I used to talk to them, you live in such a fantastic place. And they said, no, very boring. Nothing happens here. I said, oh my God, they should go to Brazil and see. And they thought that Brazil was a fantastic country, that everything was happening there. So we are always behaving like this. Yes, and then I start traveling, and I ended up by creating an underground magazine.
Now, that's, you're now entering, I think, the quote-unquote political phase of your career. You were a journalist for a while as well, but you first really began to make money, if you like, to make a living from writing, by writing song lyrics, by being a lyricist. Tell me, what kind of song lyrics did you write?
Oh, I was in this underground magazine. I had this underground magazine, but we didn't have the staff. So you put in the front page, it was only three of us, you put 20 names, you know, that you create all of them just to impress the readers, you know, director, managing director, you know. And then I was four or five of them, and my girlfriend was another three and a third person. And one day someone came, step inside, and he was dressed in a tie, very serious, and he said, I read an article by, and he quotes someone, he didn't exist. And I said, oh, he is out of for lunch, but can I help you? And he said, yes, it was about flying saucers, and I'm very interested in this. And I work as a producer for CBS, and I'm very interested. And I immediately thought, oh, probably I can get an ad, you know, from this producer from CBS, because we are running out of money. So we invited him to have dinner, but he said, no, you go to my place. And we went to his place, and there he starts showing me songs. And I was totally surprised, because behind this person wearing a tie, very serious, there was a really talented person. And at the end of 1 month, more or less, we became friends. And he told me, why don't you start writing lyrics for songs? And I said, I don't know how to do that. And I had this idea about the system. The system is everything that has nothing to do with the hippie movement. We didn't know exactly what the system was, but, you know, it involved globalization, multinational, CBS. So we were against everything. But and then Raul, this person, he, you know, in tie and working for CBS, he was the system. So, but at the end, he convinced me to start writing lyrics, and I convinced him to try a little bit of the cultural background of the hippie movement. And we made a kind of very special marriage. And he quit to be a producer, and he said, oh, well, okay, I'm going to be a rock singer. And I said, a good idea.
It worked.
Well, it happened that when he recorded his first record, it went straight to the Billboard, to the best-selling records. And I didn't have a penny at the beginning of the year, and 6 months later, I had $40,000. And I said, oh my God, what is $40,000 was for me? I don't know, I think I could buy, you know, a Mercedes-Benz or... And then I start writing and I start earning money. And it was finally that my parents, they, my son can make his living. So they relaxed and we worked together for nearly 4 years. But it was the military dictatorship and we had a lot of problems.
Yeah, because your song lyrics got you in trouble and the regime exacted its revenge and you received a very different kind of ECT treatment. Tell me about that experience.
And that is, this is not funny in the sense that it was, I think, the worst period in my life. It is that I was writing lyrics. We were discussing all the hippie ideology. And they thought, well, at that moment in Brazil, they succeed in erasing the leftist guerrilla, but they need an enemy, you know, to keep the repression going on. So they start searching for enemies, and one of them, it was, of course, successful, well, artists. And so first they went to Raul, the singer, but they realized that he was only singing, and there was someone behind who was writing the lyrics. So they thought, oh, this is the guy. And one day, out of the blue, they invited me for questioning. I went there and I was arrested. And that was really tragic because it was not an experience like the asylum, because the asylum, it was something that, well, my parents, they went, even if they were mistaken, they want something good for me. But the jail is something that destroys you, and you came out with nothing, absolutely nothing, only paranoia and fear and things like this. So to recover from this experience, it took, I don't know, 5-6 years, because even if you leave the jail doesn't leave you. You think that you are being followed, that someone is listening to your conversation. As you are totally powerless when you are in a jail, you feel the human degradation. You are not you anymore. I was given an interview 2 days ago. The title of the article, it is a Sunday Times. They have the best of the times and the worst of the times. So they normally use the best and the worst. Then I went through telling this story, and I was officially arrested, and then I was released. So the government was not responsible for me anymore. And then I was kidnapped on my way back home by the paramilitary. And then the journalist asked me, did you feel fear? I said, no, you don't feel not even fear. You are in a state of, it's nothing.
Denial.
It's like if you are a vegetable, you know, and this can last for, in my case, it lasts for 5 hours till I realized that they were not going to kill me, because the first sensation was that they were going to kill me. And so I was expecting, no, the gunshot, the bullet. But after 5 hours, and then you start feeling fear, that it is your first sensation after this state of total nothing. It is a void. I was in Auschwitz 1 week ago. I was in Poland 1 week ago, and I was looking to him. And I could fully understand how people didn't react, because it seems that they deprive you of everything that you have, including your survival instinct. It's something very, very strange.
At what point, then, did you become involved in the occult, in black magic and Satanism?
No, I was never involved in Satanism. I was involved in black magic. But
pardon me if I don't see the distinction, but
well, Satanism is you worship Satan, and black magic is when you try to affect other people's will. So the boundary between black magic and we can call white magic is invisible, because, for example, if you go to a church and you light a candle and you say, "Oh, my virgin, I want to marry this man or this woman," you are somehow asking from the virgin, you know, or from whoever you're lighting a candle, to interfere in other people's will. And this is considered to be black magic. I mean, that instead of trying to do something to yourself, you're trying to interfere in the life of other people. So it has nothing to do with Hammer Productions movies and things like this and Dracula, but with interfering in other people's will. But during the hippie period, I was very curious about what was going beyond the thing that you can accept as normal. I think all my life I had this tendency to go to extremes, and sometimes this took me to very difficult situations. And I thank God that I had help when I needed. But and then I start to study this and this, and then I start to get deeply involved on the so-called left arm of occultism. This is a much more proper expression, because when we talk about black magic or Satanism, we always go to the archetypes of the what we see as black magic in the movies. So, and it took me 5 or 6 years till I realized, also through a very painful situation, that it is fully described in The Valkyries, one of my books, that it works, but then you have to pay the bill.
Tell me about the background to the writing of The Pilgrimage, because it began with your involvement in a Catholic sect called the Order of Regnus Agnus Mundi. Tell me a little bit, what was that sect about?
In fact, after my experience with black magic and with the aftermath of this experience, I decided that I should stop this kind of spiritual searching or whatever, because I was too scary. I was totally scared. And then in 1974, I said, okay, this is enough. I had been in jail, I had been in asylum, I had been, you know, in this black magic stuff. So now it's time to become a normal person. But it was out of fear more than anything else. So in 1981, I was working again for a record company, and I decided to quit, because I was not feeling happy with the things that I was doing. But I was not interested in magics or whatever. I was only thinking that I should try to do something that it was meaningful to me. So I started traveling all over Europe and going back to my hippie friends and to see what they have done with their lives. And most of them, they settled down. Yeah. So I thought to myself, oh, probably I have to do the same thing. But I remember that I had, $27,000 that I saved for this trip. The first one, it was 200. This one was 27,000. And I was so unhappy. Oh, well, I must also tell that from the moment that I decided to quit the record company, I was fired. So it seems that the universe was conspiring to help me, regardless of the fact that I didn't recognize at that time. And then in the beginning of 1982, I met someone who, well, I had a kind of vision. It's too complicated to explain in a radio program, but I had a kind of vision. And 2 months later, I met the person, but I was thinking that, oh, this person is connected with the black magic of the 74. So I was, again, devastated. And I went to him, and he said, no, this has nothing to do, but if you want, I'm going to teach you what we call the symbolic language. The symbolic language is nothing more nor less than you understanding things that is happening since the dawn of humankind. I mean, for example, the idea of a pilgrimage. We had been pilgrims since the beginning of civilization. And it is also a very good metaphor for life, because life is somehow a pilgrimage from birth to death. So I had this idea back to my occult period that everything was very complicated. And then, in fact, this process in this realm was to simplify this search for God. It's much more easy than you think. Therefore, one day they suggested me to do the pilgrimage, which I accept, but thinking that it was a nonsense, because nobody does any pilgrimage at the end of the 20th century. But I undertook the pilgrimage in July 86.
This was to Santiago de Compostela,
yes,
in Spain.
Yes, from the southern part of Spain to Santiago de Compostela. And while walking, I learned some basics that I still carry with me. The first one is, do the pilgrimage respecting your own rhythm. So this is very important in the sense that sometimes you try to follow other pilgrims, you don't want to be alone, and then you get tired or you get bored, but you're not following your own rhythm. And the second one is travel light, in the sense that you are going to carry everything that you have with you, and you don't need that many things. And the third one is look around, and then you are going to see people. And these people, they have the right answer for any question that you have, even if they don't know that you have this question. Sometimes there is what I call the language of the omens, the language of the signs, and you can get the precise answer for a particular question. Finally, keep in mind that you have a target, that you have something that you have to fight for, and then God is all around. You don't need to go through complicated books or to very complicated ritual. You just open your heart to the Holy Ghost, that will make your life easy. So at the end of the pilgrimage, all that quest that I was on for since I was 20, that includes hippie movement, includes everything, I realized that it was much easier than I was thinking. But also I realized that famous dream about being a writer that I forgot totally was still in my heart. So I had to go back to this dream. And to be a writer, you have to write books. And it sounds, of course, obvious, but it is not, because I used to be a writer without a book. I used to introduce myself because I want to be a writer. So I used to introduce myself. I'm Paulo Coelho, and people, what do you do? I said, I did some lyrics for songs, but I am a writer. And then they used to say, and what did you write? I said, oh, I'm working in a book. But I was not. I was only delirating, only thinking about writing the perfect book, about being James Joyce, because I think the dream of every writer is to become James Joyce. So finally I realized that it was not like this, that I had to accept my destiny, which I did. I wrote my first book, The Pilgrimage.
You talked about writing the perfect book. Many people think you did write the perfect book, and it's called The Alchemist. It was the book which launched you into the world of bestsellers. It still sells. It's immensely popular. It's popular with people of influence. What do you think it is about this book which caught the imagination of so many people?
I have to stress the fact that The Alchemist was not that successful when it was released. The Pilgrimage was much more successful. It sold 3,000 copies in Brazil, that it is not a very bad sales figure. The Alchemist didn't sell at all. I remember that there was a bookstore, because The Pilgrimage sold 3,000 copies, there was a bookstore in the northern part of Brazil who ordered 6 Alchemists. And on the first day, they sold 1 copy. They were very excited. And it took another 6 months to sell the second one to the same person. To the same So at the end of the year, my publisher came to me and said, this book is not working, so here's the contract. He gave him back the contract of The Alchemist. And at that moment, I had burned all my ships, all my bridges. I was living my dream, totally committed to my dream. And so I start knocking the doors, because there is a quote in The Alchemist, probably the most famous one, that says that when you want something, the whole universe will conspire to help you. And I said, I wrote this, so I have to believe in this. So, which I do, by the way, which I do. Okay. And so I start knocking the doors, and in fact, a very famous publisher in Brazil said, well, come in. And I said, I have a wonderful book. This kind of thing that you normally say. But it still didn't sell. And he said, out of the blue, okay, let's give a second chance. Many years later, I asked him, why did you decide to publish a book that has been already published and it didn't sell? And he said, I don't know. I really don't know. And this is what is magic about life. Sometimes you don't know why you take some decision, but in fact, you take the right decision. And then on a word of mouth basis, and I think this is the answer to your question, is that people start to read it and to understand that I was not only talking about myself, because when I go back to the reason that I wrote The Alchemist, it was basically to understand all these things that have been through that we are discussing tonight with Miles. I was trying to understand myself. And then I realized later on, of course, when the book starts selling and became a worldwide phenomenon, that in fact we share more or less the same journey. We have the same challenges. We have the same, but I didn't know that when I wrote the book. I was only trying to talk to my soul. That's why, since The Pilgrimage and The Alchemist, I try to keep the same innocence concerning the writing books. You cannot think about many readers. You have to go back to your soul, to this totally unknown, deep ocean that you have inside of yourself, and try to get from there, well, things that you need to be in contact with. So I will never know the precise answer for why is The Alchemist such a successful book. But at least for me, it gave me the sensation, not only that I was not alone, but that the things that were meaningful to me, they were also meaningful to people, regardless their cultural backgrounds.
But there's a publisher somewhere in Brazil, and every time he walks past a bookshop and he sees The Alchemist in the bookshop, he goes, damn!
Now, once I told this story on television, and I regret, because I think that everybody's make some mistakes, but once I don't know, sometimes you keep this revengeful thing. I can be very bad sometimes, so that's why the devil is me, and misspring is all about. Sometimes you don't control your evil instincts. So I thought, oh my God, because I remember being totally devastated when he gave me the contract back. So one day in a television program, I mentioned, and I regret. I make some mistakes, but then I apologize.
What is an alchemist?
The idea of alchemy is, an alchemist is someone who is capable to project in the physical world all the spiritual quest. Let's go back to the example of the pilgrimage. You are doing something physical, but you are also doing something spiritual. We have this strange wall that separates the visible reality from the invisible reality. We have a lot of feelings here tonight. You know, people feel something, but we cannot see, we cannot touch. But even though there are feelings here that is affecting our conversation somehow. So the idea of alchemy, I think, is to project in this physical world, the spiritual world. And then this is the only way that justifies the spiritual world is when you have a physical manifestation. I mean, it's very easy to go and to pray and to do this and that and that, but then when you face reality, you have to have this spiritual energy within yourself. If you look to the life of Jesus Christ, I'm a Catholic myself. I became Catholic at the beginning of the pilgrimage. I returned to Catholicism. But if you look to Jesus Christ's life, you realize that he was enjoying his life, his first miracle, which was a very mundane one. It was not, let's say, heal a blind man. No. It was changing water into wine, and because there were no wine in the party. So I think this is very symbolic in the sense that he was telling us, enjoy life, no? Enjoy life because he could choose. I believe that he is the Son of God. So I have other reasons to believe that he did that on purpose to show us that there is nothing wrong with being connected to real life. And if you look into his life, you're going to see that he was always doing that, projecting in this physical world, the spiritual world. And I think that we are capable to do that. And then this is what alchemy is all about, is about this fusion.
Are you an alchemist?
I'm a shepherd boy. I try to be an alchemist. I try to be. I want to have a copy of this because I feel so relaxed here. It's the energy that we are talking, you know? So will you give me a copy of the of the whole thing, not the no? Okay, a tape, okay. So but because it's very good to be with you. And by the way, I wanted to take the opportunity to thank Sinead O'Connor. 1 year ago, she mentioned my book, Veronica Decides to Die. And she said that it was a book very meaningful to her. And I think that made all difference. So this is out of the blue, but I really wanted to thank her. She's a person that I respect, that I admire. And please don't cut that from the edited pro. Okay, don't cut that. So we are talking about alchemy.
We'll cut it out and send it to her. How about that?
Okay. So this is what is
okay, I'm not so you're not an alchemist.
No, I'm not.
You're a shepherd boy.
I'm a shepherd boy.
Given what happens in The Alchemist, is one of the things that you're saying in the book that everything you need is near you?
Yes, I'm totally convinced. But you have to pay attention to the things that are near you. Because sometimes there is a lot of things near and you don't pay attention because your eyes are used.
But so much of what you write is about journeys, yet everything you need is near you. It seems paradoxical.
Well, in fact, that there are only four stories to be written. And we are writing about these four stories since the oral tradition. So the first story, it is a love story between a man and, between two people. I was going to say a man and a woman, I said. The second story is a love story between three people, no? The third story is the struggle for power. And the fourth story is a journey. So all the books that has been written, that we go and to a bookstore to buy, they deal with one of these four major themes. Of course, you can have some small variations, but if you go to the basis, is a triangle, is this two, is the struggle for power and the journey. And I'm very seduced by the journey because I feel myself as a pilgrim. I like the fact that I need to travel. In fact, I don't need to travel, but I enjoy traveling. So since I was a hippie, so some of my books, they use the metaphor of a journey, well, for me to share some ideas. And I will say The Alchemist, River Piedra, and The Pilgrimage.
The Valkyries you mentioned, it's an account of 40 days in the desert, which is a very biblical figure and concept. What were you trying to achieve by writing The Valkyries, which is more, it's similar to The Pilgrimage in the sense that it's memoir as much as it is anything else?
Yes, it is. Of course, there are fiction, either in The Pilgrimage and in The Valkyries, but it was at that moment that I remember very well. I was in the desert, and it was when my publisher refused The Alchemist, so I was very anxious. It is a book about getting in contact with your guardian angel, so I didn't need to go to the desert. I could do it at home or whatever, but I always had this romantic side, so I think, oh, why not go into the desert? Because I have this publisher, he doesn't want to publish my book. But it is not only about the quest for the guardian angel, it is also a book about my marriage. And again, we go back to the idea of alchemy. No, I'm talking about a spiritual thing, but I'm talking about a very practical thing, that it is marriage and my problems with my wife. I don't know how many of you read The Valkyries, but you're going to see that, well, the quest for the angel and the marriage itself, they interfere in each other. And it is a book that's not translated because my agent, she's here tonight. First visit to Ireland, it's what a shame. I am in my fifth visit, I think. And she doesn't want to put too many books in the market. And I think she's very wise in doing this. But because you have to respect a kind of rhythm, you don't have Brida, and that it is about an Irish girl. And the other countries, they don't have the Valkyries. But it is a very interesting book, I think.
And to what extent do you believe literally in the concept of angels, guardian angels?
100%.
Hell, the devil?
Ah, that depends.
Okay, so that means that there is somebody there who is looking out for you and trying to protect you all the time,
absolutely.
But there isn't necessarily somebody who's out to get you all the time. Is that what?
No. But I do believe that you have a protection. You know, you have the protection from God, from angels, from what you believe. I believe in angels, so of course the angel is looking at you all the time. But and sometimes not in the way that you expect. There is a very interesting story, but it is a very long one. Go to the next question.
Go on, tell us the story. Sorry, we have a request. Tell us the story.
The story is about a man in Italy. He lives in a small city, and one night he has a dream with an angel. Probably you know that story, don't you? Okay. If some of you, if you know, you pretend that you don't know. So. And then he has a dream with an angel, and he sees his angel, and his angels tell him, oh, there will be a flood here, and there is this big dam that is going to break, but I am your guardian angel. I'm here to tell you that I'm going to save you. You don't need to worry, because you're not going to die. And so the next day, this gentleman wakes up, and it starts raining and pouring, and the flood starts, and the guy goes to the village and says, oh, I had a dream with my guardian angel, and he told me that there will be an inundation here, but I'm not going to die, so don't worry. But people are worried because there is this dam, no, that may break if it overflow. So the civil defense goes there. And you have to evacuate the city, and so everybody leaves the city. But this man refuses because his angel told him that he was not going to die. So he says, no, I stay here. You know, I had a dream with an angel. I believe in angels. And so I have nothing to be concerned or worried about. I'll be here. Don't worry. I will survive. My angel told me. And so the next day, the water is mounting. He's at the top of his roof. And then he became a kind of national attraction. The man who didn't leave the city because he had a dream with an angel, right? So they are filming him and etc. A man of faith. But they know that the dam is going to collapse and he's going to die. So they send a boat to rescue him from the top of this roof and say, go away, Satan. You know, you are trying to prove to the world that angels don't exist. You see, I'm going to stay here and I'm going to survive. Nothing is going to happen. And, well, they leave him. And in the third and final, last attempt to rescue him, they send a helicopter because at that moment he only have 1 hour. You see the cracks in the dam, but he again refuses. And then, of course, the dam collapses and he dies. And he dies, and as he was such a man of faith, he goes to heaven. And he's there, there's this beautiful gate, and St. Peter is waiting for you. But he's furious. So she looked to St. Peter and said, I'm not going inside. The owner of this place is a liar, you know? What a shame for my family. They are there, they are alive, and I'm here dead. And I had a dream with an angel, and the angel told me that I was going to survive. So I'm not going inside. I'd rather go to hell because I didn't have a dream with Satan. He didn't lie to me. And St. Peter thinks, oh, well, I don't know. Well, God never lied to anybody, but probably he's too old and who knows? No, he starts, you know, to make some confusion and sending angels to places that he shouldn't send. So, but could you wait for half an hour? I'll be back, I'll talk to him. And then the man is waiting for half an hour, and finally he returns and says, no. Yes, he told me, he sent you an angel, and the angel told you that you are going to survive. But he also said that he tried to rescue you 3 times, you know, and you didn't accept. So this is how angels work. We are always waiting for a miracle, you know, for a divine creature to take us in. So I believe that most of the times we are in front of a kind of protection that we don't recognize. How many times do we still have? Because I'm too talkative tonight. No, I recognize.
We're fine.
You said 1 hour.
How do you communicate with an angel, or how does an angel communicate with you?
I think that from the moment that you have an open heart, you are always in contact with your angel. You don't need to think about it. You just need to believe. You know, because if you start to think, to elaborate a language, to elaborate, no, you believe, and then you start to get signs and omens, and your angel is guiding you and protecting you. Of course, in most of the times, you don't realize that you had been protected because no tragic thing happened to you. But in fact, at that very moment, the angel pushed something aside, and you just think that nothing happened. But happen.
Angels come into, and the devil comes into the devil and Miss Prim, very obviously. And it's about the conflict between good and evil. I'm not quite sure, having read it, who exactly wins, or does anybody win, or does the book end up simply by recognizing that we are capable of both good and evil?
Yeah, I think this is the correct answer for the question. I think that I try to use in writing The Devil and Miss Prim, most of the traditional legends about good and evil. And I think that we don't have a clear answer to that question. Of course, you can simplify. You can lie to yourself. You can lie to your readers. But at the end, the reader will recognize and will never forgive you. So there is no answer to that question. And we have been dealing with that question since the dawn of humankind. It's better to say, okay, nobody wins. Wins the one who is able to control him or herself. I think this is, if you can synthesize a book, because it's quite difficult to synthesize a book, you know. You write a book because you have a lot of things to say. And then to put in just one sentence is very difficult. But I would say that it is a matter of self-control. And it's also much more intelligent to do good things than to do bad things, because at the end you have to pay for bad things that you did. Not in the Christian, old Christian sense, that you get totally trapped in your things that you don't do properly, correctly.
I was interested in a lot of the things that were said in the book, but one thing that particularly struck me, I'm not quite sure why, you say in the book that people seek suffering in the most joyous of places because they think they are unworthy of happiness. What did you mean by that?
Exactly that. I mean,
I was hoping for a little elaboration.
I think this
just a little.
Very clear thought.
That is.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. That's fine. Your work is adored by millions, 32 million copies, so we are talking about millions, but it's actually despised by a lot of critics. It's been described, for example, as shake and vac for the soul. One review of The Alchemist said the absence of characterization and overall blandness suggests the authorship by a committee of self-improvement pundits. One critic in Brazil said, I don't like it and I've never read it. So we'll dismiss him straight away. But does your work appeal, not necessarily because it's major work, but because people are hungry for something spiritual in writing?
No, I don't agree with you. I think that, to begin with, I think that critics, they play a very important part in the sense that my books had been criticized from the very beginning, when I released The Pilgrimage and then The Alchemist. So, on my third book, about this Irish girl called Brida, I had to choose. Was I convinced about the things that I was doing or not? Because there are several writers that they just accept what the critics are saying, and then start to please the critics. They are not going to please the critics, but they are not totally convinced about what they write. So I decided to choose the critics as my adversaries, in the good sense, because you choose your friends, but you also choose your adversaries in the sense that they are going to teach you a lot of things that you have to learn. And one of them is to be totally convinced that you are doing the thing that you want to do. And at the end of the battle, you can win, you can lose, but you cannot tell to yourself, oh, I didn't know, or I was not totally convinced. So as for Brazil, today the reviews are excellent because I overcome, I think, the only real important task as far as critics are concerned, it is time. So after writing for 15 years and having my books read and respected, they finally start reading my books. And they realize that not only it was not so bad, and then they have to justify the past. And this is complicated. They start to create sentences that I don't understand, but that they mean, I like your book. But I cannot just say, I like your book, so I say, there is a symbolic thing there and there. They use a very sophisticated word to say that they are starting to like. I think this is totally normal. When you are showing something, when you're sharing something, you have to be prepared to face criticism and also to fight for the things that you believe. So they helped me. They really helped me because they didn't ignore me. And I think this is a recognition that I exist.
You mentioned your relationship with this country. This is your fifth visit. Your last visit was to make a documentary, and that documentary was about the phenomenon in the middle 80s in this country of moving statues and materializations of the Virgin Mary. One of the things that interested me was that one of the things that comes across is your belief in omens and in signs. Now, does that mean that you think that God singles you out, and presumably if he singles you out, he singles everybody out and sends omens and signs to everybody? Do you think that that actually happens, or what do omens signify to you?
I do think that everybody has omens. You have to develop a kind of personal language alphabet to God. And as you told me at the very beginning, that this is the largest part of our conversation, because he said, at the end, I'm going to mention the movie. So we realized that we're going to the end. So probably I tell you the story. How did this thing happen, no? They are here, the producer. Oh, they are sitting there. And then I was signing in Munich. I was in a line, there was a line in for sign, you know, everybody queuing, and then this couple, this very gentle couple, came to me and they said, well, we want to do a documentary. They didn't explain very much. No? And every day I got propositions for documentaries, films, and so I said, talk to my agent that today also is sitting here in the opposite side of... And they said, we talked to your agent. And she said, now he's in Croatia, now he's in Switzerland, now he's in I don't know where. And we have been following you. And she's always postponing this meeting. So we decided to take a plane to come to Munich and to talk to you. We want to do a documentary. But I was in a hurry, you know, people queuing. So I said, okay, so thank you very much for coming. Ta. Sign, look into the eyes, because I think that you have to respect your readers. And you have to... No, you cannot discuss documentaries there, no, in the middle of a signing section. And they also look too young. So I continue signing and talking to my readers, because signing sections is a very moving thing. Yesterday I signed from 6 till nearly 12 o'clock in London. It was the biggest signing in the... Monica has a fax proving that. In Borders. And I was not tired at all at the end of the signing, because you get this kind of feedback. Writing is very lonely. You never have the possibility to look it into the eyes of your reader. So it is a unique chance for that, as tonight here. But they were there waiting. So back to the impulse, when I was living with my publicist, a friend, another friend, I saw this nice couple waiting at the bottom of the stairs, and I said, you are still here? They said, yes. We're waiting to talk to you. And I said, but I told you that tomorrow I'm going to travel. I forgot to where, but to someplace. They said, no, but 5 minutes. Said, 5 minutes. They always say 5 minutes, but anyway. I said, okay, let's have a coffee. And they were so kind. We went to the restaurant, and then I said, let's have a dinner. And then we had a dinner, but I was with several friends. So I was making jokes or behaving seriously. I don't remember how I was behaving, but not very nice, because I was at the end of a long tour. So finally, after they wait for, I don't know, 3 hours to talk 5 minutes to me, I was going to my room, and I said, okay, now you... They said, no, hour 5 minutes. I said, okay, let's go to my room. And I went to my room, and Lim took a bottle like this of water and put in front of me, and he said, this is sacred water from Mallory, from Capoquin. I have this dream of doing a documentary on some apparitions there. I wish you can come and participate in this documentary. So he explained, he outlined me the idea. But again, it was late in the night, and I said, okay, I call you. I call you means nothing. But there was this bottle sitting there at the top of the table, and I was thinking, well, I cannot drink everything that they give me to drink, so what shall I do with this bottle? At the same time, it may be a sacred bottle, sacred water inside. So I put this kind of strange test. If I have to drink from this water, the water will show me how. I went to sleep. Next day, 7 o'clock, I had to leave the hotel. I left, I looked at the bottle there. I said, okay, so you stay there, I'm not going to. But it may be sacred, so I live there, and the next person will read sacred water from Mallory, and it's up to the next person to take the decision what they are going to do with this water. So I went to the car, and all of a sudden I realized that I forgot something very important. So I went back to my room, and then it was like the bottle was omnipresent, you know, it was there. And I got to the thing that I forgot, that I said, this is an omen. I should drink from this bottle, otherwise I would not forget something here. And then you have to believe that you are following the omens, right? It is a bet. You believe or you don't believe. It's a matter of attitude in life, and I understood this as an omen. So I drank, I left, and since then I start to get some very kind emails. And what about the film? And what about the movie? What about the bottle? What about the island? And I
what
was...
What did they put in it?
And they were postponing. I have heard about the moving statues and everything. And finally, I don't want to elaborate too much, but I start getting omens to come to Ireland. You should go to Ireland. You should go to Ireland. And then I remember the documentary thing. And then I talked to them and I said, you know, you have Sinead O'Connor, you have Enya, you have a lot of very famous people to go to the countryside, because what they went to me and in the last email they finally explained, it was to go to Capricorn to see whether these apparitions were true or not, which I'm not in a position to judge up to today. I believe they are true, but because I believe in miracles. But anyway, they want me to go there to elaborate on that. And I said, okay, I have 1 week. And at the same time, I was talking to someone from Regnus Agnus Mundi, no, the Catholic order that I belong to. The person said, related to the documentary, has, be obedient. Have this kind of humbleness that you need to have from time to time, you know, to obey everything. Because this is a very good exercise. You know, sometimes you are humble for 1 week. Not more than 1 week, but you can be very obedient and humble. Just experience, you know, obedience. It's good for discipline, it's good for the soul. And then I called them, and I went to Cape Queen. And I spent a fantastic time there. Because you go, the apparitions took place in 1985, 16 years ago. And in fact, it was my spiritual journey. It has nothing to do with the documentary. They thought that I was there for the documentary. I was thinking that I was there to learn or to get in touch, in contact with these people, and they are fantastic. At the same time, it was a possibility to be in an Irish countryside, you know, for 1 week and living with them and worshiping with them and drinking with them and understanding that the pipe of Guinness beer has to be like Jesus and their good Guinness, bad Guinness, because for me everything was Guinness, you know. So, but you have... You're like experts, so today I know how to drink a good Guinness. But anyway, and then we had this fantastic experience, and it was very magical. But at the end of the week, of course, I said, okay, I have to go to another place. But he was never satisfied. And he thought that I would be always this very humble servant that I was during this week. So they keep on calling me, oh, there's sound missing, and there's this and that and that. And finally they managed to meet me in Lourdes. That I always go to Lourdes I feel very close to the feminine face of God there in Lourdes. And it seems that they finished. Although today I had a lunch with the producer. She said there is still missing something, but they have to be at the Cork Festival, right? So they have to finish. But it was not only a very moving experience. Of course, I was not there to judge. I was there to have this experience that you have when you are open to it. I think that is what life is all about, is about being open. So he kept on asking me, is it true, is not true? And of course, even if for me it is true, I don't mention this in the film because I don't think it is good to judge. So, but it was then that I think that for the first time I was able to really understand the Irish soul. It was there, and during the day, talking to farmers, to people that you say very simple, they are not very simple, they are very connected. I do believe that the connection, the more you simplify your life, the more connected you are with God. And then at night, of course, drinking and singing and fighting. One day I had this question, I asked, what do you think about Michael Collins, the movie? And then one said one thing, the second said one, and in half an hour they were fighting. You know, they were fighting. I was horrified. I was looking. And then another half an hour they were friendly again. So I said, oh, they look like Brazilians. But I would like, I understand that this is the end. First of all, I would like to thank you for guiding this interview in a very relaxed way. I felt at home. I think that this experience in Mallory was, for me, the revelation of Irish soul. You can see it in Dublin, yes, of course. But for a foreigner, he has to go probably deep in the countryside to understand better. And then now I can see it here. And all my journeys to Ireland, my trips, my magic moments here. I'm not telling you just because I'm here, but Monica knows, my agent knows, how close to Ireland my soul is. And Ireland is you, are you. So I would like really to thank you from the bottom of my heart for being here and for listening to me. And thank you for your mic.
Today's program is produced by Kevin Reynolds. Sound supervision is by Pat Hogan and Johnny Craig.
Drama on One. Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One.